Okay, I think we're going to get started. So the name of this session, I got to check, God's Big Story in Innovation with Dr. Brian Fickert and myself, Tabitha Kapik. Welcome. We are excited to get started, and what we want to get started with is you talking to each other. So you need to turn to someone. So if there's no one around you, you're going to have to probably move. Introduce yourself, your name, church, city, and role, and then answer the question, yes or no, have you ever tried something new at a church that worked? And switch. So let's just take about 2 minutes to do that. If time allows, you can share the story, but I'm going to keep us moving pretty briskly through. So go ahead and follow those instructions and talk with each other. Okay, thank you so much. Hopefully you've made a new best friend in 3 minutes. It is my honor to introduce the first speaker. This is what, I tried to get AI to generate an introduction, but this is it right here, the founder of the Chalmers Center and professor at Covenant College. But the only thing you really need to know about Brian, the only thing he really cares about, are these three ladies right here. This is his wife, Jill Fickert, and their twin granddaughters. So that's the best introduction I can give him. So Brian, let me hand off to you.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you folks. Some of you have big questions here, like how tall is that guy? So let me address that right away. I'm 6'10". I'm of Dutch descent. The Dutch are the tallest nation in the world. My wife, I married her. She's 5'5". I married her to dilute the gene pool. It didn't work. I've got three kids, and they're beautiful inside and out, but they're not reverting to the mean. And my granddaughters, who you just saw in that picture, are in the 95th percentile. It's hopeless. It's absolutely hopeless. So the Chalmers Center that we represent tries to equip churches and Christian ministries to work amongst people who are poor in more effective ways. And we're probably best known for our book, When Helping Hurts. But since that book came out, people have continued to have some questions about what they're supposed to do. And so in light of those questions, I was privileged to co-author two books with Kelly Kapik, who's Tabitha's husband, who's a Trinitarian theologian at Covenant College, and they're called Becoming Whole and The Field Guide to Becoming Whole. I'm going to give you just a little preview of that, and that's going to lay the groundwork for what Tabitha is going to do. And I've been told I've got 20 minutes, and she doesn't believe I'm going to finish in 20 minutes. I'm going to do it. All right, you watch. Here we go. Ready? So I want you to answer this question. Just for yourself, why did Jesus come to earth? Think about your answer. And I would ask you to share with each other, but you're all afraid you're going to get excommunicated or something for being a heretic. So just relax. I guarantee that whatever you are saying or thinking is true. So just relax. All right, but how would you answer that question? Why did Jesus come to earth? And remember your answer, all right, because we're going to come back to it later on. The second question I have for you is this. Why do you think there's such an increase in anxiety and mental health issues right now in America? Why? So think of your answer to that. Why is there? Share with your neighbor. Go fast. Why is there such an increase in anxiety and mental health problems in America right now? Share with your neighbor. That means you have to talk to each other. Okay, that's enough relationship building. What's your answer? So somebody share. What do you got? What's the cause of it? Arminianism, right? No, come on. Give me something. Social media, right? How many people think it's social media? That's part of it. What else? Breakdown of the family. Uh-huh. What's causing that? Social media, right? No. So there's a lot of research being done right now on the effect of social media on mental health. And some of you probably know the work of Jonathan Haidt and The Anxious Generation. And I embrace all that. I think it's all true. But I want to show you something. This is depression, anxiety and depression amongst college-age young people in America from the 1938 to 2007. So I actually believe that iPhones and social media are contributing to mental health problems. But I want you to notice that we actually have had a problem for a long time. And I think there's been an upswing recently. But if you go back to the 1930s onwards, you can see that anxiety and depression have continued to increase in America. So something is going wrong. It's not a new story. It's actually a long-run trend. What is it? What's going wrong? Well, human beings are shaped by stories. We live into stories that tell us what is the good life and how can we achieve that good life. And there's two stories that profoundly shaped everybody in this room and have influenced what happens in the space of poverty alleviation, okay? So the first story is the story of what we might call the American dream. Now, I love America, so just chill out, all right? But the American dream, one way of summarizing the American dream is this. The American dream, in one version of it, an extreme version, says human beings are fundamentally physical creatures, all right? And so I'm an economist by training. This creature right here is at the center of my discipline of economics. We call this creature Homo economicus. Yeah, we're a really sexy group of people. So we call this Homo economicus. This is a self-centered, highly individualistic, highly materialistic, autonomous creature. It's a consuming robot. And in that story, happiness comes from consuming more stuff. So the goal is more stuff. How do you get more stuff? You work like a dog. You work hard to earn more income so that you can buy more stuff. Well, the truth of the matter is, we've been pretty successful at creating stuff. So this is, the blue line is real income per capita. So it's sort of the average income of Americans. This goes from 1972 to 2008. And the blue line is average income per person. And you'll see it go straight up, right? The red line is the self-reported happiness of Americans. How happy are you? Now, there's all kinds of issues that go into your, I'm Dutch, and we're always miserable. Yeah, I could win the lottery and say, oh, it all sucks, it's terrible. Now, but what you'll notice is on average, Americans, while our income has gone up and up and up, the self-reported happiness of Americans has stayed constant over this time period. It's actually starting to decline. Folks, to an economist, this is the equivalent of saying the resurrection didn't happen. I cannot conceive of this as an economist, that we'd have more and more income so we can buy more and more stuff, but we're not happier. That just undermined my PhD. It's really great to find that out. If you look at more recent years, happiness is declining. And then, of course, we've got this longer-term trend that I mentioned earlier. Anxiety and depression continue to rise. There's a growing amount of evidence that suggests that what's causing this is actually our pursuit of the American dream. That as we pursue higher incomes, more and more wealth, that we're actually becoming more and more like Homo economicus. We're becoming more and more like self-interested, self-centered, highly materialistic creatures. We're becoming like the story that we are living into, and that's contributing to the mental illness. Folks, everything I believe can be summarized in one picture. We're created to live in a certain kind of habitat, but we're not in that habitat. We're living right now in a habitat created for Homo economicus, and that's not actually how we're designed to be. And so if you live outside the habitat that you're created for, it doesn't work. That's what's going on. We've created a habitat that's the ideal habitat for Homo economicus, but we're not that kind of creature. And so it's like we're living outside of the only habitat in which we can actually flourish. What's so interesting is that we're exporting this to the rest of the world. So through the process of globalization, the rest of the world is taking on Western-style economic institutions, stories, and practices. And you know what? They really, really, really work great at producing wealth and increasing incomes. It works. This is the percentage of people living below the poverty line of $1.90 per day from the year 1990 to the year 2015. And what you'll see is a dramatic reduction in poverty around the world as places like India and China adopt Western-style capitalism. Everybody relax, just chill. All right, I like markets more than you do. Like on vacation, you all like go and look at sightseeing. I go to the marketplace and watch people trade. All right, so I'm all in. But if you look, this is crazy. What's happened is incomes have gone up and up and up all over the world. That's caused reductions in poverty by over 50% in a time period of only 25 years. Folks, this is one of the greatest achievements in all of human history. This is unbelievable. The percentage of people living in extreme poverty was reduced by more than 50% in only 25 years. For most of human history, people just lived in poverty. This is a crazy story. Western-style capitalism works really great for creating an environment that produces things. But then we've got this. This is a book written by an economist called Happiness Around the World, The Paradox of Happy Peasants and Miserable Millionaires. What we're seeing all around the world is the same thing that we're seeing in America. Western-style institutions are really good at producing stuff. They're not very good at producing human flourishing, because what we're actually seeing all over the world is the same thing we're seeing in America. Places that are being influenced by globalization are experiencing rapid economic growth, plummeting levels of poverty, diminished happiness, and rising anxiety and depression. It's the same story. We're spreading the wrong habitat around the world. There's an irony here. We're miserable, but we're saying to poor people, come be like us. Come join us in our misery. It's terrible, but come join us. That's the story. False story number two. Now, you're all kind of going, yeah, that American dream stuff, that's not me. But now we're going to get a little, now it's going to get a little closer to home. By the way, everybody has a spiritual gift, mine is offensiveness. Some got love, joy, peace. I got offending the audience no matter what. All right, that's who I am. All right, here we go. The baptized American dream, what I think has happened to a lot of us in the church, certainly it's been true of me, is I've thought of the human being not just as a body, but as a body that contains a soul. And the idea here in this story is that the body and the soul are separable, right? We kind of believe that, right? At death, our bodies and our souls are separate. So there's some separation going on. And what we kind of really believe is that the real game, what really matters, is to get the soul to heaven for all eternity, to float around in clouds, wearing diapers and playing harps. And so the real goal in the baptized American dream, so the story of American Christianity, is get the soul to heaven. We don't have a story for this life. The church hasn't given us much of a story. So what do? We revert to the only story we know, the story of the American dream. So what most of us do in our churches, I believe, is we get our souls to heaven by accepting Christ as our Savior, and if you're Presbyterians, baby, you're all locked in because eternal security is there. So we're locked in. There's nothing to worry about, right? And so what do? I live my best life now. Get my soul to heaven, live my best life now, pursue the American dream. You know what happens? When you live in the wrong habitat, Monday through Saturday, it doesn't work. When you live in the habitat for homo economicus, it doesn't work. Christian young people are experiencing the same kinds of increases in anxiety and depression that the kids in the world are experiencing because they're living in the wrong habitat. Well, what's the right habitat? The right habitat is the habitat that God created. Now, right down the hall, Greg Beale is giving a workshop. Why you folks aren't there instead of here is absolutely beyond me. I would be there. But what Greg Beale has really helped us to understand is what is the nature of the right habitat. And the story goes like this, that God in creation makes us in his image. We're bodies. We are bodies that contain souls. But now, watch this, guys. I'm old. And you just got to watch these slides, man. This actually works. So watch this here. Ready? We have bodies that contain souls, but the body and the soul are highly integrated. So what happens to us physically affects us spiritually. What happens to us spiritually affects us physically. You see this in the Psalms. David's always crying out in his bed, going, oh, my bones are aching because of my sin. We're highly integrated. And there's more. We're made in the image of God, and God is inherently a relational creature from all eternity. Not creature, sorry. Can we edit that out? This is on, oh, he's not a creature. Tabitha said that, not me. God is inherently a relational being. From all eternity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost exist in deep communion with one another. And he's made us in his image. And so human beings are hardwired for relationship. For relationship with God, self, others, and creation. Folks, this is the hardest part for Americans to get. Especially me, because I'm Dutch. Right? We don't have any relationships. If I wave at somebody when I'm driving down the street, I call that intimacy. All right? I mean, right? We've got a Dutch pastor over here. I'm a relational theorist. I don't actually want to have any. Now, who we are is we're not just bodies. And we're, what time is it? What are we doing? We're not just bodies, and we're not just bodies that contain souls, and we're not just highly integrated bodies and souls. We're highly integrated body-soul relational thingies. So what happens to us relationally affects us physically and spiritually. Why was COVID so bad? Isolation. If we're wired like Homo economicus, or if we're wired like baptized Homo economicus, COVID isn't a problem. Why? You stay home, you work, you earn your income, you buy your stuff. If you're Homo economicus, you're fine. If you're baptized Homo economicus, you get your soul to heaven and you eat stuff now. There's no problem. But that's not what happened, is it? The isolation, the broken relationship with others reverberated through our entire personhoods because we're highly integrated body, soul, relational thingies. The Surgeon General has determined that loneliness has the same impacts on life expectancy as smoking 15 cigarettes per day. What happens to us relationally affects us physically and spiritually. It's a different anthropology. And what God does is he puts this creature into the only habitat in which this creature can flourish. It's the habitat of Eden. What Greg Beale has demonstrated through his biblical scholarship is that Eden was a temple. A temple is a place where God and human beings dwell together in intimate relationship. In the garden, Adam and Eve are dwelling in the presence of God. That's good because we're hardwired for a relationship with God. It's part of our personhood. It's that relationship with God part. Dignity, relationship with self. Adam and Eve had dignity not because they produced something, but simply because God said it. You have dignity and worth as my image bearer. Relationship with others, deep community between Adam and Eve. And what Greg Beale has shown is that Adam and Eve had a vocation in the garden temple. That their relationship to creation was to act as priest rulers. They were to protect the garden temple, but they were to expand it through work. Not work to earn an income so you can buy more stuff, but work as worship to God and service to others. And so these are the conditions for human flourishing. When I think about helping poor people, what's in the back of my head is, how can I help poor people to experience the conditions of Eden? Because that's what they're wired for. And that's what I'm wired for. And so if you can create a ministry that has those four components, you will start to see, in most cases, progress. That's it. We're created for a certain habitat. If you can recreate that habitat, it will tend towards progress. Now, some of you are going, what about Jesus? We're getting there. Hold on. Now, the fall happens. Most of us have been trained to think that the fall creates a legal problem for us with a righteous and holy God. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. The wages of sin are death. I affirm that wholeheartedly. But folks, there's more than that. You see, what happens to Adam and Eve in the fall is that their relationship with God is severed, and because they are highly integrated body-soul relational creatures that reverberates through all of their relationships, you can see it right in Genesis chapter 3, and it drives right down and affects their bodies and their souls. Folks, Adam and Eve it's more than a legal problem. They're hardwired to dwell in God's presence, and they're cast out of the only habitat in which they can flourish. It must have been terrifying. So they're cast out of the only habitat in which they can flourish. The entire gospel is in this one picture. They're made to be in here, and they're out there. And this is a Presbyterian fish. It's dead in its trespasses and sins. It's got a legal problem, and it can't even function. It's dead. It's a Presbyterian fish. The problem we have is that we're dead, and we're not in the habitat in which we can flourish. What's redemption? Well, what did you say? What did you say? To redeem his people. It's true. Nobody can get this one wrong. I promise you. Everybody's going, you can't get it wrong. Everything you say is going to be true. Redeem his people. What else? Reverse the curse. Yeah, you're all being really sophisticated. So what most Christians would say is, he died on the cross to pay the penalty for my sins so that my soul can go to heaven someday when I die. I believe that's true. It's a legal answer. It's true. Hallelujah. My sins are nailed to the cross. I bear them no more. Oh, without that, I'm lost. But folks, there's more. Jesus says at the start of his earthly ministry that he's come to preach the good news of the kingdom of God, that's why he was sent. That's the overarching story. If you only focus on the legal dimension, you don't have an answer for what to do Monday through Saturday when the alarm clock goes off. If you only focus on the legal dimension, my belief is you're going to end up in a baptized American dream framework. My soul's secure. I'm all locked in, baby, because I'm a Presbyterian. It's eternal security. I'm locked in. Now the alarm clock goes off on Monday morning. What do I do? But what if the story is bigger? What if it's a story of redemption for the entire cosmos? What if it's that Jesus is ushering in a kingdom that makes all things new? And look what happens in Revelation 21. What's it going to look like? In Revelation 21, in the picture of the new creation, the picture of the new kingdom, if you ask me what's going to be like, I'd say no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain, no more poverty. But it starts, that's all true, by the way, but it starts off with something. Now the dwelling of God is with people. This is Eden restored. This is the habitat in which we can flourish, being restored. And we get our old jobs back there. We're not floating around on clouds, because look what it says. You made them be a kingdom and priests to serve our God and to reign on the earth. Adam and Eve were given the vocation of priest rulers. In the new creation, they get the vocation of priest rulerness back. It's wholeness. We're created for relationship with God, self, others, and creation. What's that got to do with the present? Well, the local church is kind of like the pulling forth from the future into the present. Eden. It's the dwelling place of God. It's where God dwells. He's everywhere, but he relates particularly intensely in a certain way in the local church. And you know what? We get our old jobs back. Now, 1 Peter chapter 2, we are the chosen people, the royal priesthood, the holy nation. We're supposed to be what Adam and Eve were, not in the old creation, but in the new creation, which burst forth from a tomb 2,000 years ago. Our calling is to live into God's story, to seek first his kingdom, which is to seek first a habitat where human beings can live in right relationship with God, self, others, and creation. That's the job. That's the job of all of us. But this takes creativity. I don't know exactly what the kingdom of God looks like when I walk out the door here. I don't know. I've got to imagine what might it look like. And how could I make it look a little bit more like that right now to tell the story of Christ and what he's doing? This is a church in rural Togo. Very poor church. Togo is one of the poorest countries in the world. It's the center of witchcraft and voodoo in the world. If you Google sightseeing in Togo, nothing comes up except for one thing. The witchcraft market, the fetish market, where you go and buy chicken's feet and other kinds of, and rabbit's feet to appease, to try to control the demonic realm. This is a church in rural Togo. These are women who've been told for hundreds of years they're from the wrong tribe, the wrong gender, and they are no more than dogs and cats, and demons are in control. These women are being brought through God's story. Creation, fall, redemption. Who are you? You're made in the image of God. You're an image bearer. You're now restored as an image bearer in Christ. It's not just a legal thing. It's a human beingness thing. And you're called to go out and be that in your community. Can you imagine what that might look like? And they start imagining using a process called Innovate that Tabitha's going to introduce you to in a second. They start imagining. And they go out and they say, you know what? We're going to make a difference in our community. Let's go be restored priest rulers. And so they went out and they started to repair the roads. They're about an hour drive off the paved road. And you can see the roads are dirt. And when the rains come, the roads wash out. You can't get trucks through and you can't get the produce to markets. It's a terrible thing. So they're out there. They're repairing the roads. They're repairing. There's snakes in the grass. They're cutting down the grass to get rid of the snakes. The whole village came out and said to them, what are you doing here? And they said, well, we serve a God who's the Lord of heaven and earth. And he's put us as stewards over this community. We should stop waiting for other people to come fix it. We should fix it ourselves. But they became Republicans. They're out there. So the whole village came out and joined them. There's a witch doctor from a neighboring village who was visiting this village. He saw this whole thing. He said to these women, I will give you land in my village if you will come and plant a church in my village, because I want this God to reign in my village too, because he makes things better. Why not in your church? Why not in your church? Your people are Presbyterian restored priest rulers. Why not in your church?
Okay, thank you, Brian. Now we're going to try to answer his last question there, the why not in your church. So bear with me as I switch over. First, I want to talk, because we're telling you innovate is important, innovation is important. I want to tell you how we define innovation, talk a little bit about it. This is a picture of the first human landing on the moon. See, it's 1969. It's mind-blowing. There were a million little innovations that had to take place for this to happen. But I'm actually more interested in what happened 3 years later, because it wasn't until 1972 that humans put wheels on suitcases. And even though a lot of things bring me delight about a human being on the moon, the fact that my suitcase rolls behind me brings me great delight. I'm waiting for the Mandalorian floating Baby Yoda suitcase that when I walk, it just follows me. It's coming. So how do we know if innovation happened? How do I know if innovation happened? Well, my little shorthand for it is that someone experienced relief, delight, or hope. That's how you know something innovative happened. And that some sort of change persists over time. So it's a pretty simple thing. It's not necessarily getting someone on the moon. It might be an improvement like those wheels on a suitcase. So the Chalmers Center, oh, and by the way, Brian, you did great. You did 125% of 20 minutes. So good job. It used to make me nervous. It doesn't anymore. I have a little trick with that. Usually I go first and then give him the time, but it's good stuff. It was good. So Brian told you a little bit about the history of the Chalmers Center. Brian, with his shiny Yale PhD in economics, eventually landed at Covenant College and started the Chalmers Center. And he had this idea that if he could take asset-based development and get that tool, God's big story of change, into the hands of the church, something beautiful could happen. So he's just shared with you God's big story of change. And he wrote a book about a decade ago called When Helping Hurts. It was a decade ago, right? Something. And that really changed how a lot of us thought about poverty alleviation in our churches and just in our lives. And he told you a bit about these newer books that he and my husband worked together on. And One of the things we realized with When Helping Hurts is it created some angst in the poverty alleviation space. Like, okay, we know we're doing it wrong. How do we do it right? Chalmers created some wonderful resources that I'll show you at the end that you can run ministries out of your church. But it quickly became apparent we could not create 1,000 ministries and hand them off to you. It would be foolish to try. What we needed was to give you a process that you and your church could use so that you could create ministries that truly empower people. You are the experts in your church, in your context, in your community. Chalmers is not. So we set out, starting in 2019, to create this process. Everyone wants to help without hurting, but how do you actually get there? So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Innovate, and then we're going to use some tools together. So you'll have to talk to each other again and be relational in just a minute. Innovate combines principles from three kind of schools of thought. I love this artist rendering of a city in Yawata, Japan, where three streams come together. And that's God's story of change, the asset-based approach, and then design thinking, which not a lot of us know that much about design thinking, but I'll bring you up to speed pretty quickly. Now, we know that poverty is caused by three things, broken people, broken systems, and demonic forces. You can see that this is the relational, connected thingy, thought, soul, body thingy that he described. And these are the relationships that get affected by the fall. But when we look at sin, we've got broken people who have broken relationships, broken systems, and then demonic forces. It's easy to forget about demonic forces in the U.S. context. But if you talk to your missionaries overseas, they can tell you a lot of stories. Satan works differently in different contexts. He knows his audience and he adjusts. So Innovate is a distinctive process because of those three principles that are combined, those three disciplines, but also it's very fast. It gets people up and moving. On the left, you'll see a picture. It's employee training for a cafe. This is in Oklahoma City. And they hire people who are coming out of homelessness, addiction, to work in their cafe. Through taking Innovate, they came through and did the online version. They realized that they weren't transmitting the mission to these employees. And so they redesigned their employee training to include that. And it's really changed how they interact with people. On the right-hand center, this woman, we'll call her Maria, is in a drop-in center for women in Memphis that are trapped in both addiction and prostitution. And it's just a place they can stop by for a couple hours and just have some time in a safe place. And they went through the Innovate process. And one of the things they realized is that the women in this situation didn't want to hear the gospel from men necessarily. It was sometimes pastors in the community, police officers who they suffered at the hands of. So they created the idea, the ministry, that women that had already come out of that lifestyle would share the word of God. Often the women are quite under the influence when they come in, so very brief times of sharing. But this woman, Maria, she chose homelessness. She had many opportunities to get out of it, but she wanted to stay with her community. And she felt called to lead a Bible study. So the ministry worked with her, got her some more training in biblical teaching. And this drop-in center has grown exponentially in Memphis. It's been used by, we had a tiny church join us online, and they created urban gardening interventions for students. This is a group that started pairing up whole churches, in this case, Christ Temple Church, with one person who was coming out of prison or coming out of homelessness, so that a church had special care for one person. We took this training, Innovate, to Ukraine. We pulled all the Ukrainians out, or they did, brought them into Romania. These are pastors, their spouses, and other church leaders. They came during wartime, went back into war, and created new ministries to war widows, to injured soldiers. There's one church that can't even talk about what they do because they visit injured Russian soldiers in Ukrainian hospitals. So they just have to keep it completely under. Also, cities that have been abandoned during the war, there are people who've left behind, and it's usually the disabled and the elderly. And so one of these churches goes back and takes them food. So just beautiful, beautiful ministries come out of this. The one thing that happens with churches who go through this is their church turns outward more readily. I don't care if you are a poor church on the coast of Ecuador or you're in Illinois, this is the experience of people who go through Innovate, of just that turning outwards and understanding how to create more of that flourishing Eden place that Brian was talking about. So the first thing I want to talk to you about is asset-based versus need-based. Very technical sounding, but I'll break it down for you. Let's discover what's there before we decide what's missing. So when you start this process, you don't start with what's wrong, let's fix it. You actually start with what is already there in the community. So why? Why do we start that way? Well, in a need-based approach, you are looking only at problems and what's missing from a community. Solutions often come from the outside in, and the people who may be struggling are cast as victims and consumers, and that sort of role is just reinforced. You'll recognize, maybe you've seen a photo of something like this before. This is a photo from the Great Depression. This is a long line of men lined up to get free soup. When you think of a soup kitchen and a handout, you know, you might conjure up in your mind a row of people on one side of the table ladling out soup to a line of people on the other side. It's transactional. The haves are giving to the have-nots. At Chalmers, we think of a different metaphor. We think of a potluck. That actually, what's wonderful about a potluck is everybody brings what they're good at, and you gather and you share a meal. This is the idea of poverty alleviation that we want to leave with you. That metaphor of how can we come together? And even the people we're trying to serve, what gifts do they have? So asset-based solutions are actually possibility-oriented. They start with what a community already has, like what your church already has. Solutions move from inside the community outward, and the people who maybe are struggling with material poverty are cast not as victims, but survivors, providers, producers, image bearers of Christ. So now I want to take some time for you to talk to each other and just think through. We've kind of made some categories here for assets that your church or community has or ministry. You see the five categories here: spiritual, people and groups, physical and events, and I'll just explain that one. That's like things that happen every year. So your church building is an asset, and maybe the Christmas social is something that happens every year. Institutional assets and economic assets. So please just take a moment and turn back to that person or make a small group and try to put one in each of these white boxes. Like, think of one spiritual asset. You can take turns that your church has and move on. So let's just take like 3 minutes and do that. Okay. That's great. I love the engagement. Allows everyone to wake up, get talking. I'm going to share with you some that I wrote down. And I want you to tell me what I missed. So I did a quick brainstorm about these, like spiritual assets. We have the sacraments. People in groups, we could go on and on with that. And what I'll say about people in groups is in every church I know, there's like that person or two who knows everyone and knows everything. That key person, I often write down their name as an asset, that particular person. And you might have several of those. But what can you think of anything that's not up here that you all talked about? Just say it out loud. Teaching, that's great. Where did you put it under? Okay, great. Yeah, the categories kind of go into each other. Other things, what's anything else that you came up with? Well, it's an institutional asset. So the fact that there is government and that there are roads that get to your church and police, like we have a police officer at my church who just comes each Sunday. So things like that. Yeah, one of the most interesting conversations I've had around assets was someone had listed a mosque as an asset. And man, we all, the whole group went back and forth on that because it was interesting conversation. I won't recreate it. Other things, does anyone have like a school associated with their church? That's a huge asset. So I wanted to start us off positive. We are going to next talk about challenges, but we want to start with what is already there, what is already happening in your church. Now, let's take a second to look at challenges. I'm just going to pop some up. So one of the ones we don't think about a lot in this country is demonic forces. So at Chalmers Center, we have a lot of spiritual warfare that happens. And it's a little bit of a joke, but it's not very funny because we can tell when something's coming up, we'll just start saying, okay, we're all under attack. We have individual sin, communal sins, people in groups, this old adage that 20% of the people do 80% of the work. You might have encountered that. Physical and events, deferred maintenance on buildings, that is so hard to get to. Inadequate spaces to meet or to park. Inadequate technology. Overcommitted people don't go to things at church. Institutional, anti-Christian government policies. I don't know if anyone's from California. I'm originally from there, and my family was there, and they reopened. I think they reopened bars before they reopened churches. Economic resources, low tithing, high needs. Seminary didn't have a financial audit class. Global local economies affect the church economy. So these are some of the challenges. And just for our purposes here, I sort of selected the challenge that we're going to spend a little time on, just a couple minutes. So let's ask the correct question. Oh, I went too fast. Before we create an incorrect solution. So if you were in Innovate, we'd look at the assets and the challenges, and then we'd create a how might we question, because good questions equal good ideas. I'll take you through this really quick. The way we create a how might we question for brainstorming is how might we, and then you just add the change you want to see. So you might say, how might we engage more members to get involved? How might we turn members' hobbies into work for the church? How might we make church volunteering fun? How might we reimagine volunteering as part of one's spiritual development? Again, I cheated and I chose one for you. So we're going to brainstorm right now on how we might make church volunteering fun. Okay? I'm going to give you a few of ideas I came up with, and then I want you to also think of them. So as I say the ideas, hopefully it'll spark something in your mind. So maybe we say we have people volunteer in pairs. You can't solo volunteer. Make volunteering part of good parenting. Like, you're showing your child that you're volunteering. There's not a lot of volunteer ministry opportunities for a whole family. It's kind of hard to figure that piece out, but it's quite powerful for children and for families. Boy, this is not showing up. Team up with a local nonprofit or another church. Offer more one-off or short-term service opportunities. Add food. That is always a go-to. If you add food, they will come. Use small groups as engagement teams that take on a few service opportunities. Build volunteer opportunities into what people are already doing. They're already there. Make volunteering into a game with prizes and a leaderboard or server board, which is such a dad joke. So these are just some ideas I had, but what ideas do you have? If you think about making volunteering fun, maybe think about a time when you had fun volunteering. I might say, in addition to add food, I would say like add dogs or other animals. What ideas have sparked in your mind? Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. So lining up opportunities with people's gifts and passions. And that makes you think of a lot of things. You need to figure out what their gifts and passions are. And you need to, you know, do that work of connecting them to something that would feed those. Other ideas. Ooh, I love that. No, intergenerational is great. You've seen probably those things where they have seniors or retirees reading to preschool children. Great intervention. Other ideas. What would make it fun? Yes, we could do this, have people volunteer in pairs and pair up maybe people that are intergenerationally spiritual. Well, I think we could think of a better word for that. Don't you, Mike? Mike and my husband, Kelly, went to seminary together in the 90s, RTS Orlando. Great. Okay, I'm going to hasten on. So can innovation ignite the church? What we would do after we came up with all those ideas is we'd choose one, and then we'd start thinking about ways we could do little experiments with it, which is why I asked at the beginning, have you ever tried anything that actually worked? A lot of the reason it doesn't work is because we don't do this experimentation part. We just launch full programs without testing like little parts of the whole design. Okay, so I hope we've shown you that innovation can ignite the church. This is a ministry in Washington Park, Illinois, and they had multiple churches volunteer to make a shipping container into a tiny home. And they made a community of 10 homes was their goal, and they've just finished it. And men pay a percentage of their income, which could be quite small, as rent. But they are paying rent. And this is just an amazing intervention for homelessness to me. And it puts people in community with their own space. Churches, government, and nonprofits all collaborated. So there's other things that you can find on our website. But I want to get to an invitation for today. Starting at 4:30, an 8-minute walk from here, is the Chalmers Center offices. And you can click on this QR code or just show up. We are so fun at Chalmers. So you really should come by and talk with us, and we can tell you about the resources we have for your church. And I'm not sure what the hors d'oeuvres are, but I'm sure they'll be great. So thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be up here if you have any questions. Thanks so much.